Rin felt a pang of disappointment at those words. Not for herself, but for the Empire. It was difficult to know that she lived in a world where humans had once freely spoken to the gods but no longer did. How could an entire nation simply forget about gods that might grant unimaginable power? Easily. That's how. The world was simpler when all that existed was what you could perceive in front of you. Easier to forget the underlying forces that constructed the dream. Easier to believe that reality existed only on one plane. Rin had believed that up until this very moment, and her mind still struggled to readjust. But she knew the truth now, and that gave her power. Rin stared silently out over the valley below, still grappling to absorb the magnitude of what she had just learned. Meanwhile, Jiang packed the powders into a pipe, lit it up, and took a long, deep draft. His eyes fluttered closed. A serene smile spread over his face.
"Up we go," he said.
The thing about watching someone get high was that if you weren't getting high yourself, things got very boring very soon. Rin prodded Jiang after a few minutes, and when he didn't stir, she went back down the mountain by herself. If Rin had thought Jiang might let her start using hallucinogens to meditate, she was wrong. He made her help out in the garden, had her watering the cacti and cultivating the mushrooms, but forbade her to try any plants until he gave her permission.
"Without the right mental preparation, psychedelics won't do anything for you," he said. "You'll just become terribly annoying for a while."
Rin had accepted this initially, but it had now been weeks. "When am I going to be mentally prepared, then?"
"When you can sit still for 5 minutes without opening your eyes," he said.
"I can sit still. I've been sitting still for nearly a year. That's all I've been doing." Jiang brandished his garden shears at her.
"Don't take that tone with me."
She slammed her tray of cacti clippings on the shelf. "I know there are things you're not teaching me. I know you're keeping me behind on purpose. I just don't understand why."
"Because you worry me," said Jiang. "You have an aptitude for lore like no one I've ever met, not even Alton. But you're impatient. You're careless. And you skimp on meditating."
She had been skimping on meditating. She was supposed to keep a meditation log, to document each time she made it to the end of an hour successfully. But as coursework from her other classes piled up, Rin had neglected her daily requisite period of doing nothing.
"I don't see the point," she said. "If it's focus that you want, I can give you focus. I can concentrate on anything. But to empty my mind? To be devoid of all thought? All sense of self? What good does that serve?"
"It serves to sever you from the material world," Jiang answered.
"How do you expect to reach the spirit realm when you're obsessing over the things in front of you?" "I know why it's hard for you. You like beating your classmates. You like harboring your old grudges. It feels good to hate, doesn't it? Up until now you've been storing your anger up and using it as fuel. But unless you learn to let it go, you are never going to find your way to the gods."
"So give me a psychedelic," she suggested. "Make me let it go."
"Now you're being rash. I'm not letting you meddle in things that you barely understand yet. It's too dangerous."
"How dangerous could it be to just sit still?"
Jiang stood up straight. The hand holding the shears dropped to his side.
"This isn't some fairy story where you wave your hand and ask the gods for 3 wishes. We are not fucking around here. These are forces that could break you."
"Nothing's going to happen to me," she snapped. "Nothing's been happening to me for months. You keep going on about seeing the gods, but all that happens when I meditate is that I get bored, my nose itches, and every second takes an eternity."
She reached for the poppy flowers. He slapped her hand away.
"You're not ready. You're not even close to ready."
Rin flushed. "They're just drugs.
Just drugs? Just drugs?
Jung's voice rose in pitch.
I'm going to issue you a warning, and I'm only going to do it once. You're not the first student to pledge lore, you know. Oh, Sinigar's been trying to produce a shaman for years. But you want to know why no one takes this class seriously?
Because you keep farting in faculty meetings?
He didn't even laugh at that, which meant this was more serious than she'd thought. Jung, in fact, looked pained.
We've tried, he said. 10 years ago, I had 4 students just as brilliant as you, without Alton's rage or your impatience. I taught them to meditate. I taught them about the Pantheon. But those apprentices only had one thing on their minds, which was to call on the gods and siphon their power. Do you know what happened to them?
They called the gods and became great warriors? Rin said hopefully.
Jung fixed her with his pale, suffocating gaze.
They all went mad. Every single one. 2 were calm enough to be locked in an asylum for the rest of their lives. The other 2 were a danger to themselves and others around them. The Empress had them sent to Bagra.
She stared at him. She had no idea what to say to that.
I have met spirits unable to find their bodies again, said Jung.
He looked very old then.
I have met men who are only halfway to the spirit realm, caught between our world and the next. What does that mean? It means don't fuck around.
He tapped her forehead with each word.
If you don't want that brilliant little mind of yours to shatter, you'll do as I say.
The only time Rin felt fully grounded was during her other classes. These were proceeding at twice the rate as they had her first year, and though Rin barely managed to keep up given the absurd course load Jung had already assigned her, it was nice to study things that made sense for a change. Rin had always felt like an outsider among her classmates, but as the year carried on, she began to feel as if she inhabited an entirely separate world from them. She was steadily growing further and further away from the world where things functioned as they should, where reality was not constantly in flux, where she thought she knew the shape and nature of things instead of being constantly reminded that really she knew nothing at all.
Seriously? Kitai asked over lunch one day. What are you learning?
Kitai, like everyone else in her class, thought that lore was a course in religious history, a smorgasbord of anthropology and folk mythology. She hadn't bothered to correct them. Easier to spread a believable lie than to convince them of the truth.
That none of my beliefs about the world were true,
Rin answered dreamily.
That reality is malleable. That hidden connections exist in every living object. That the whole of the world is merely a thought. A butterfly's dream.
Rin?
Yes?
Your elbow is in my porridge. She blinked.
Oh, sorry.
Kitai slid his bowl farther away from her arm.
They talk about you, you know. The other apprentices.
Rin folded her arms.
And what do they say?
He paused.
You can probably catch the drift. It's not, good.
Had she expected anything else? She rolled her eyes.
They don't like me. Big surprise.
It's not that, Kitai said. They're scared of you.
Because I won the tournament?
Because you stormed in here from a rural township no one's ever heard of, then threw away one of the school's most prestigious bids to study with the Academy madman. They can't figure you out. They don't know what you're trying to do.
Kitai cocked his head at her.
What are you trying to do?
She hesitated. She knew that look on Kitai's face. He'd been wearing it more often of late, as her own studies grew more and more distant from topics that she could easily explain to a layman. Kitai hated not having full access to information, and she hated keeping things from him. But how was she supposed to articulate the point of studying lore to him, when often she could barely justify it to herself?
Something happened to me that day in the ring, she said finally. I'm trying to figure out what.
She'd braced herself to deal with Kitai's clinical skepticism, but he only nodded.
And you think Jiang has the answers?
She exhaled.
If he doesn't, nobody does.
You've heard the rumors, though.
The madmen, the dropouts, the prisoners at Bagra, she said. Everyone had their own horror story about Jiang's previous apprentices.
I know. Trust me, I know. Kitai gave her a long, searching look. Finally, he nodded toward her untouched bowl of porridge. She'd been cramming for one of Jima's exams. She'd forgotten to eat.
Just take care of yourself, he said.
Second years were granted eligibility to fight in the ring. Now that Alton had graduated, the star of the matches turned out to be Naja, who was rapidly becoming an even more formidable fighter under June's brutal training. Within a month, he was challenging students 2 or 3 years his senior. By their second spring, he was the undefeated champion of the rings. Rin had been eager to enter the matches, but one conversation with Jiang had put an end to her aspirations.
You don't fight,
he said one day as they were balancing on posts above the stream. She immediately splashed into the water.
What?
She sputtered once she climbed out.
The matches are only for apprentices whose masters have consented.
Then consent!
Jiang dipped a toe into the water and pulled it back out, gingerly.
Nah.
But I want to fight!
Interesting, but irrelevant.
But—
No buts. I'm your master. You don't question my orders. You obey them.
I'll obey orders that make sense to me,
she retorted as she teetered wildly on a post. Jiang snorted.
The matches aren't about winning. They're about demonstrating new techniques. What are you going to do? Light up in front of the entire student body?
She didn't push the point further. Aside from the matches, which Rin attended regularly, she rarely saw her roommates. Niang was always working overtime with Enro, and Venka spent her waking hours either on patrol with the city guard or training with Neja. Kitai began studying with her in the women's dormitory, but only because it was the one place on campus always guaranteed to be empty. The newest class of first years had no women, and Kareel and Arda had left the academy at the end of Rin's first year. Both had been offered prestigious positions as junior officers in the 3rd and 8th divisions, respectively. Alton, too, was gone, but no one knew which division he had joined. Rin had expected it to be the talk of campus, but Alton had vanished as if he'd never been at Synegard. The legend of Alton Trengzin had already begun to fade within their class, and when the next group of first years came to Synegard, none of them even knew who Alton was. As the months passed, Rin found that one unexpected benefit of being the only apprentice who had pledged lore was that she was no longer in direct competition with the rest of her classmates. By no means did they become friendly. But Rin stopped hearing jokes about her accent. Venka stopped wrinkling her nose every time they were both in the women's dormitory. And one by one, the other Synegardians grew accustomed to, if not enthusiastic about, her presence. Naja was the sole exception. They shared every class except combat and lore. They each did their best to utterly ignore the other's existence. Many of their advanced classes were so small that this often became incredibly awkward, but Rin supposed cold disengagement was better than active bullying. Still, she paid attention to Naja. How could she not? He was clearly the star of the class. Inferior to Kitai perhaps in only strategy and linguistics, but otherwise Naja had essentially become the new Alton of the school. The masters adored him. The incoming class of pupils thought he was a god.
He's not that special, she grumbled to Kitai. He didn't even win his year's tournament. Do any of them know that?
Sure they do.
Kitai,
not looking up from his language homework, spoke with the patient exasperation of someone who'd had this conversation many times before.
Then why don't they worship me? Rin complained.
Because you don't fight in the ring.
Kitai filled in a final blank on his chart of Hesperian verb conjugations.
And also because you're weird and not as pretty.
In general, however, the childish infighting within their class had disappeared. It was partly because they were simply getting older, partly because the stress of the trials had disappeared, apprentices were secure in their enrollment so long as they kept their grades up, and partly because their coursework had gotten so difficult they couldn't be bothered with petty rivalries. But near the end of their second year, the class began to split again, this time along provincial and political lines. The proximate cause was a diplomatic crisis with Federation troops on the border of Horse Province. An outpost brawl between Muganese traders and Nicotta laborers had turned deadly. The Muganese had sent in armed policemen to kill the instigators. The border patrol of the Horse Province responded in kind. Master Irja was summoned immediately to the Empress's diplomatic party, which meant strategy was cancelled for 2 weeks. The students didn't know that, though, until they found the hastily scrawled note Irja had left behind.
Don't know when I'll be back. Open fire from both sides. 4 civilians dead.
Niang read Irja's note aloud.
God! That's war, isn't it?
Not necessarily.
Kitai was the only one who seemed utterly calm.
There are skirmishes all the time.
But there were casualties.
There are always casualties, said Kitai. This has been going on for nearly 2 decades. We hate them. They hate us. A handful of people die because of it.
Nakata citizens are dead! Niang exclaimed.
Sure, but the Empress isn't going to do anything about it.
There's nothing she can do, Han interrupted. Horse Province doesn't have enough troops to hold a front. Our population's too small. There's no one to recruit from. The real problem is that some warlords don't know how to put national interest first.
You don't know what you're talking about, Naja said.
What I know is that my father's men are dying on the border, said Han.
The sudden venom in his voice surprised Rin.
Meanwhile, your father's sitting pretty in his little palace, turning a blind eye because he's kept nice and safe between 2 buffer provinces.
Before anyone could move, Naja's hand shot toward the back of Han's neck and slammed his face into the desk. The classroom fell silent. Han looked up, too stunned to retaliate. His nose had broken with an audible crack. Blood streamed freely down his chin. Naja released Han's neck.
Shut up about my father.
Han spat out something that looked like a fragment of a tooth.
Your father's a fucking coward.
I said shut up!
You have the biggest surplus of troops in the Empire and you won't deploy them,
Han said.
Why, Naja? Planning to use them for something else?
Naja's eyes flashed.
You want me to break your neck?
The Muganese aren't going to invade,
Kitai interrupted quickly.
They'll make noise on the Horse Province border, sure, but they won't commit ground troops. They don't want to make Hesperia angry.
The Hesperians don't give a shit,
said Han.
They haven't bothered with the Eastern Hemisphere for years. No ambassadors, no diplomats.
Because of the armistice, Kitai said. They think they don't need to. But if the Federation tips the balance, they'll have to intervene. And Mugen's leadership knows that.
They also know we have no coordinated frontier defense and no navy,
Han snapped.
Don't be delusional.
A ground invasion is not rational for them,
Kitai insisted.
The armistice benefits them. They don't want to bleed thousands of men in the Empire's heartland. There will be no war.
Sure.
Han crossed his arms.
What are we training for, then?
The second crisis came 2 months later. Several border cities in Horse Province had begun to boycott Muganese goods. The Muganese governor generals responded by methodically closing, looting, then burning down any Nakata businesses located on the Muganese side of the border. When the news broke, Han abruptly departed the academy to join his father's battalion. Jima threatened permanent expulsion if he left without permission.
Han responded by tossing his armband onto her desk. The third crisis was the death of the Federation's emperor. Nikara spies reported that the Crown Prince Ryohai was lined up to succeed to the throne, news that deeply unsettled every master at the academy. Prince Ryohai, young, hot-headed, and violently nationalist, was a leading member of Mugen's war party.
"He's been calling for a ground invasion for years,"
Irja explained to the class.
"Now he has his chance to actually do it."
The next 6 weeks were terribly tense. Even Kitai had stopped arguing that Mugen would do nothing. Several students, most from the Outer North, put in requests for a home leave. They were denied without exception. A few left regardless, but most obeyed Jima's command. If it came down to a war, then some affiliation with Sinigard was better than none. The new Emperor Ryohai did not declare a ground invasion. The Empress sent a diplomatic party to the Longbow Island, and by all accounts was politely received by Mugen's new administration. The crisis passed, but a cloud of anxiety hung over the academy still, and nothing could erase the growing fear that their class might be the first to graduate into a war. The one person seemingly uninterested in news of Federation politics was Jiang. If asked about Mugen, he grimaced and waved the subject away. If pressed, he squeezed his eyes shut, shook his head, and sang out loud like a little child.
"But you fought the Federation!" Ren exclaimed. "How can you not care?"
"I don't remember that," Jiang said.
"How can you not remember that?" she demanded. "You were in the Second Poppy War. All of you were."
"That's what they tell me," Jiang said.
"So then..."
"So I don't remember,"
Jiang said loudly, and his voice took on a fragile, tremulous tone that made Rin realize she had better drop the subject or risk sending him on a week-long spell of absence or erratic behavior. But as long as she didn't bring up the Federation, Jiang continued to conduct their lessons in the same meandering, lackadaisical manner. It had taken Rin until the end of her first year of apprenticeship to learn to meditate for an hour without moving. Once she could do that, Jiang had demanded that she meditate for 5. This took her nearly another year. When she finally managed it, Jiang gave her a small, opaque flask, the kind used to store sorghum wine, and instructed her to take it to the top of the mountain.
"There's a cave near the peak. You'll know it when you see it. Drink down that flask, then start meditating."
"What's in it?"
Jiang examined his fingernails.
"Bits and things."
"For how long?"
"As long as it takes. Days, weeks, months. I can't tell you before you start."
Rin told her other masters that she would be absent from class for an indefinite period of time. By now they had resigned themselves to Jiang's nonsense. They waved her off and told her to try not to be gone for more than a year. She hoped they were joking. Jiang did not accompany her to the top. He bade her farewell from the highest tier of the campus.
"Here's a cloak in case you get cold. There's not much up there in terms of rain shelter. I'll see you on the other side."
It rained the entire morning. Rin hiked miserably, wiping mud off her shoes every few steps. When she reached the cave, she was shivering so hard that she almost dropped the flask. She glanced around the muddy interior. She wanted to build a fire to warm herself, but couldn't find any material for kindling that wasn't soaked through. She huddled into the far end of the cave, as far away from the rain as she could get, and assumed a cross-legged stance. Then she closed her eyes. She thought of the warrior Bodhidharma, meditating for years while listening to the ants scream. She suspected that the ants wouldn't be the only ones screaming when she was done. The contents of the flask turned out to be a slightly bitter tea. She thought it might be a hallucinogen distilled in liquid, but hours passed and her mind was as clear as ever. Night fell. She meditated in darkness. At first, it was horribly difficult. She couldn't sit still. She was hungry after 6 hours. All she thought about was her stomach. But after a while, the hunger was so overwhelming that she couldn't think about it anymore, because she couldn't remember a time when she hadn't been this hungry. On the second day, she felt dizzy. She was woozy with hunger, so starved that she couldn't feel her stomach. Did she even have a stomach? What was a stomach? On the third day, her head was delightfully light. She was just air, just breath, just a breathing organ, a fan, a flute, in, out, in, out, and on. On the fifth day, things moved too fast, too slow, or not at all. She felt infuriated by the slow passage of time. Her brain was racing in a way that wouldn't calm. She felt as if her heartbeat must now be faster than a hummingbird's. How had she not dissolved? How had she not vibrated into nothingness? On the seventh day, she tipped into the void. Her body became very still. So still that she forgot she had one. Her left finger itched, and she was amazed at the sensation. She didn't scratch it, but observed the itch as if from the outside, and marveled that after a very long time, it went away by itself. She learned how breath moved through her body as if through an empty house. Learned how to stack her vertebrae one by one on top of each other so her spine formed a perfectly straight line, an unobstructed channel. But her still body became heavy. And as it became heavy, it became easier and easier to discard it, and to drift upward, weightless, into that place she could glimpse only from behind closed eyelids. On the ninth day, she suffered a geometric assault of lines and shapes without form or color, without regard to any aesthetic value except randomness. "You stupid shapes," she thought over and over again like a mantra. "You stupid fucking shapes." On the 13th day, she had a horrible sensation of being trapped, as if buried within stone, as if covered in mud. She was so light, so weightless, but she had nowhere to go. She rebounded around inside this bizarre vessel called a body like a caught firefly. On the 15th day, she became convinced that her consciousness had expanded to encompass the totality of life on the planet. The germination of the smallest flower to the eventual death of the largest tree. She saw an endless process of energy transfer, growing and dying. And she was part of every stage of it. She saw bursts of color in animals that probably didn't exist. She did not see visions, precisely, because visions would have been far more vivid and concrete. But nor were the apparitions merely thoughts. They were like dreams, an uncertain plane of realness somewhere in between, and it was only by washing out every other thought from her mind that she could perceive them clearly. She stopped counting the days. She had traveled somewhere beyond time, a place where a year and a minute felt the same. What was the difference between finite and infinite? There was being and non-being, and that was it. Time was not real. The apparitions became solid. Either she was dreaming or she had transcended somewhere. But when she took a step forward, her foot touched cold stone. She looked around and saw that she stood in a tiled room no larger than a washroom. There were no doors. A form appeared before her, dressed in strange garb. At first she thought it was Alton, but the figure's face was softer, its crimson eyes rounder and kinder. "They said you'd come," said the figure. The voice was a woman's, deep and sad. "The gods have known you'd come." Rin was at a loss for words. Something about the woman was deeply familiar, and it wasn't just her resemblance to Alton. The shape of her face, the clothes she wore. They sparked memories Rin didn't know she had. Of sands and water and open skies.
You will be asked to do what I refused to do, said the woman. You will be offered power beyond your imagination. But I warn you, little warrior. The price of power is pain. The Pantheon controls the fabric of the universe. To deviate from their premeditated order, you must give them something in return. And for the gifts of the Phoenix, you will pay the most. The Phoenix wants suffering. The Phoenix wants blood.
I have blood in abundance, Rin answered. She had no idea what possessed her to say it, but she continued. I can give the Phoenix what it desires, if the Phoenix gives me power. The woman's tone grew agitated.
The Phoenix doesn't give. Not permanently.
The Phoenix takes, and takes, and takes. Fire is insatiable.
Alone among the elements. It will devour you until you are nothing.
I'm not afraid of fire, said Rin.
You should be, hissed the woman.
She glided slowly toward Rin. She didn't move her legs, didn't quite walk, but simply appeared larger and closer with every passing moment. Rin couldn't breathe. She didn't feel the least bit calm. This was nothing like the peace she was supposed to have achieved. This was terrible. She suddenly heard a cacophony of screams echoing around her ears, and then the woman was screaming and shrieking, writhing in the air like a tortured dancer, even as she reached out and seized Rin's arm. Images spun around Rin, brown-skinned bodies dancing around a campfire, mouths open in grotesque leers, shouting words in a language that sounded like something she'd heard in a dream she no longer remembered. The campfire flared and the bodies fell back. Burned. Charred. Disintegrating to nothing but glistening white bones. And Rin thought that was the end of it. Death ended things. But the bones jumped back up and continued to dance. One of the skeletons looked at her with its bare, toothy smile, and beckoned with a fleshless hand. From ashes we came, and to ashes we return. The woman's grip around Rin's shoulders tightened. She leaned forward and whispered fiercely in Rin's ear, Go back! But Rin was enticed by the fire. She looked past the bones into the flames, which were furling upward like something alive, taking the shape of a living god, an animal. A bird. The bird lowered its head at them. The woman burst into flame. Then Rin was floating upward again, flying like an arrow at the sky to the realm of the gods. When she opened her eyes, Jiang was crouched in front of her, watching her intently with his pale eyes.
What did you see?
She took a deep breath. Tried to orient herself to possessing a body again. She felt so clumsy and heavy, like a puppet formed badly out of wet clay. A great circular room, she said hesitantly, squinting to remember her final vision. She did not know if she was having trouble finding the words, or if it was simply her mouth that refused to obey. Every order she gave her body seemed to happen only after a delay. It was arranged like a set of trigrams, but with 32 points splitting into 64, and creatures on pedestals all around the circle.
Plinths, Jiang corrected.
You're right. Plinths.
You saw the Pantheon, he said. You found the gods.
I suppose. Her voice trailed off. She felt somewhat confused. Had she found the gods? Or had she only imagined those 64 deities, spinning about her like glass beads?
You seem skeptical, he said.
I was tired, she answered. I don't know if it was real, or
I mean, I could have just been dreaming.
How were her visions any different from her imagination? Had she seen those things only because she wanted to?
Dreaming?
Jung tilted his head.
Have you ever seen anything like the Pantheon before? In a diagram? Or a painting?
She frowned. No, but...
The plinths. Were you expecting those?
No, she said. But I've seen plinths before. And the Pantheon wouldn't have been too difficult to conjure from my imagination.
But why that particular dream? Why would your sleeping mind have chosen to extract those images from your memory compared to any other images? Why not a horse? Or a field of jasmine flowers? Or Master Juin riding buck naked on the back of a tiger?
Rin blinked.
Is that something you dream about?
Answer the question, he said.
I don't know, she said, frustrated. Why do people dream what they dream?
But he was smiling, as if that was precisely what he'd wanted to hear.
Why, indeed.
She had no response to that. She stared blankly out at the mouth of the cave, mulling these thoughts in her mind, and realized that she had awoken in more ways than one. Her map of the world, her understanding of reality, had shifted. She could see the outlines, even if she didn't know how to fill in the blanks. She knew the gods existed and that they spoke. And that was enough. It had taken a long time, but she finally had a vocabulary for what they were learning now. Shamans, those who communed with the gods. The gods, forces of nature. Entities as real and yet ephemeral as wind and fire themselves, things inherent to the existence of the universe. When Hesperians wrote of God, they wrote of the supernatural. When Jung talked of gods, he talked of the eminently natural. To commune with the gods was to walk the dream world, the world of spirit. It was to relinquish that which she was, and become one with the fundamental state of things. The space and limbo where matter and actions were not yet determined. The fluctuating darkness where the physical world had not yet been dreamed into existence. The gods were simply those beings that inhabited that space. Forces of creation and destruction. Love and hatred. Nurturing and neglect. Light and dark. Cold and warm. They opposed one another and complemented one another. They were fundamental truths. They were the elements that constituted the universe itself. She saw now that reality was a facade, a dream conjured by the undulating forces beneath the thin surface. And by meditating, by ingesting the hallucinogen, by forgetting her connection to the material world, she was able to wake up.
I understand the truth of things. She murmured. I know what it means to exist.
He smiled.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
She understood then that Jung was very far from mad.
He might, in fact, be the sanest person she had ever met.
A thought occurred to her.
So what happens when we die?
Jung raised an eyebrow.
I think you can answer that.
She mulled over this for a moment.
We go back to the world of spirit. We leave the illusion. We wake up.
Jung nodded.
We don't die so much as we return to the void. We dissolve. We lose our ego. We change from being just one thing to becoming everything. Most of us, at least.
She opened her mouth to ask what he meant by that, but Jung reached out and poked her in the forehead.
How do you feel?
Incredible, she said. She felt more clear-headed than she had in months, as if all this time she'd been trying to peer through a fog and it had suddenly disappeared. She was ecstatic. She'd solved the puzzle. She knew the source of her power. And now all that remained was to learn to siphon it out at will.
So what now?
Now we've solved your problem, said Jiang. Now you know how you are connected to a greater web of cosmological forces. Sometimes martial artists who are particularly attuned to the world will find themselves overwhelmed by one of those forces. They suffer an imbalance, an affinity to one god over the others. This happened to you in the ring. But now you know where that flame came from, and when it happens to you again, you can journey to the Pantheon to find its balance. Now you're cured.
Rin jerked her head toward her master. Cured? Cured? Jiang looked pleased, relieved, and serene, but Rin only felt confused. She hadn't studied lore so that she could still the flames. Yes, the fire had felt awful, but it had also felt powerful. She had felt powerful. She wanted to learn to channel it, not to suppress it.
Problem?
Jiang asked. I don't... She bit down on her lip before the words tumbled out of her mouth. Jiang was violently averse to any discussion of warfare. If she kept asking about military use, then he might drop her again the way he had before the trials. He already thought she was too impulsive, too reckless and impatient. She knew how easily she might scare him off. Never mind. If Jiang wasn't going to teach her to call the power, then she'd figure it out for herself. So what's the point of this? She asked. Just to feel good?
The point? What point? You're enlightened. You have a better understanding of the cosmos than most theologians alive.
Jiang waved his hands around his head.
Do you have any idea what you can do with this knowledge? The Hinterlanders have been interpreting the future for years, reading the cracks in a tortoise shell to divine events to come. They can fix illnesses of the body by healing the spirit. They can speak to plants, cure diseases of the mind.
Rin wondered why the Hinterlanders would achieve all of this and not militarize their abilities, but she held her tongue. So how long will that take?
It makes no sense to speak of this in measurements of years, said Jiang. The Hinterlanders don't allow interpretation of divinations until one has been training for at least 5. Shamanic training is a process that lasts across your lifetime.
She couldn't accept that, though. She wanted power, and she wanted it now, especially if they were on the verge of a war with the Muganese. Jiang was watching her curiously. Be careful, she reminded herself. She still had too much to learn from Jiang. She'd have to play along.
Anything else?
He asked after a while. She thought of the Spearly Woman's admonitions. She thought of the phoenix, and of fire and pain. No, she said. Nothing else.
Part 2, Chapter 10. The Emperor Ryohai had now patrolled the eastern Nikara border in the Narin Sea for 12 nights. The Ryohai was a lightly built ship, an elegant Federation model designed for slicing quickly through choppy waters. It carried few soldiers. Its deck wasn't large enough to hold a battalion. It wasn't doing reconnaissance. No courier birds circled the flagless masthead. No spies left the ship under the cover of the ocean mist. The only thing the Ryohai did was flit fretfully around the shoreline, pacing back and forth over still waters like an anxious housewife. Waiting for something. Someone. The crew spent their days in silence. The Ryohai carried only a skeleton crew, the captain, a few deckhands, and a small contingent from the Federation Armed Forces. It bore one esteemed guest, General Jin Seryu, Grand Marshal of the Armed Forces and esteemed advisor to Emperor Ryohai himself. And it bore one visitor, one Nikara who had lurked in the shadows of the hold since the Ryohai had crossed into the waters of the Narin Sea. Site Commander Tyr was good at being invisible. In this state he did not need to eat or sleep. Absorbed in the shadow, shrouded in darkness, he hardly needed to breathe. He found the passing days irksome only due to boredom, but he had maintained longer vigils than this one. He had waited a week in the bedroom closet of the dragon warlord. He had spent an entire month ensconced under the floorboards beneath the feet of the leaders of the Republic of Hesperia. Now he waited for the men aboard the Riohai to reveal their purpose. Tyr had been surprised when he received orders from Sinigard to infiltrate a Federation ship. For years, the Syke had operated only within the Empire, killing off dissidents the Empress found particularly troublesome. The Empress did not send the Syke overseas, not since her disastrous attempt to assassinate the young Emperor Riohai, which had ended with 2 dead operatives and another driven so mad he had to be carted off, screaming to a plinth in the stone prison. But Tyr's duty was not to question, but to obey. He crouched inside the shadow, unperceived by all. He waited. It was a still, windless night. It was a night heavy with secrets. It had been a night like this one, so many decades ago, when the moon was full and resplendent in the sky, that Tyr's master had first taken him deep into the underground tunnels, where light would never touch. His master had guided him around one winding turn after another, spinning him about in the darkness so that he could not keep a map in his head of the underground labyrinth. When they'd reached the heart of the spider's web, Tyr's master had abandoned him within. "Find your way out," he had ordered Tyr. "If the goddess takes you, she will guide you. If she does not, you will perish." Tyr had never resented his master for leaving him in the darkness. Such was how things must be. Still, his fear had been real and urgent. He had lingered in the airless tunnels for days in a panic. First had come the thirst, then the hunger. When he tripped over objects in the darkness, objects that clattered and echoed about him, he knew they were bones. How many apprentices had been sent into the same underground maze? How many had emerged? Only one in Tyr's generation. Tyr's shamanic line remained pure and strong through the proven ability of its successors, and only a survivor could be instilled with the gifts of the goddess to pass down to the next generation. The fact that Tyr was given this chance meant that every apprentice before him had tried and failed, and died. Tyr had been so scared then. He was not scared now. Now, aboard the ship, the darkness took him once more, just as it had 30 years ago. Tyr was swathed in it, an unborn infant in his mother's womb. To pray to his goddess was to regress to that primordial state before infancy, when the world was quiet. Nothing could see him. Nothing could harm him. The schooner made its way across the midnight sea, sailing skittishly, like a little child doing something that it shouldn't. The tiny boat wasn't a part of the Nikara fleet. All identifying marks had been clumsily chipped off its hull. But it sailed from the direction of the Nikara shore. Either the schooner had taken a very long and convoluted route to meet with the Riohai in order to fool an assassin that the Riohai didn't know it had on board, or it was a Nikara vessel. Tyr crouched behind the masthead, spyglass trained on the schooner's deck. When he stepped out of the darkness, he experienced a sudden vertigo. This happened more and more often now, whenever he had waited in shadows for too long. It became harder to walk in the world of the material, to detach himself from his goddess. "Careful," he warned himself, "or you won't be able to come back." He knew what would happen then. He would become a spouting, unstoppable conduit for the gods, a gate to the spirit realm without a lock. He would be a foaming, useless, seizing vessel, and someone would cart him off to the Chulu Korik, where he couldn't do any harm. Someone would register his name in the wheels and watch him sink into the stone prison, the way he'd imprisoned so many of his own subordinates. He remembered his first visit to the Chulu Korik, when he had immured his own master in the mountain.
stood before him, face to face, as the stone walls closed around his master's mien. Eyes closed. Sleeping, but not dead. The day would come soon when he would go mad if he left, and madder still if he didn't. But that was the fate that awaited the men and women of the Psyche. To be an Empress's assassin meant early death or madness, or both. Tyr had thought he might still have one or two more decades, as his master had before he'd relinquished the goddess to Tyr. He thought he still had a solid period of time to train an initiate and teach them to walk the void. But he was following his goddess's timeline, and he had no say in when she would ultimately call him back.
I should have chosen an apprentice. I should have chosen one of my people.
5 years ago, he'd thought he might choose the seer of the Psyche, that thin child from the hinterlands. But Chaghan was so frail and bizarre, even for his people. Chaghan would have commanded like a demon. He would have achieved utter obedience from his underlings, but only because he would have taken away their free will. Chaghan would have shattered minds. Tyr's new lieutenant, the boy sent to him from the academy, made a far better candidate. The boy was already slated to command the Psyche when the time came that Tyr was no longer fit to lead. But the boy already had a god of his own. And the gods were selfish. The schooner halted under the Ryohai's shadow. A solitary, cloaked figure climbed into a rowboat and crossed the narrow distance between the two ships. The Ryohai's captain ordered ropes to be lowered. He and half the crew stood on the main deck, waiting for the Nikara contingent to come aboard. Two deckhands helped the cloaked figure onto the deck. She pulled the dark hood off her head and shook out a mass of long, shimmering hair. Hair like obsidian. Skin of a mineral whiteness that shone like the moon itself. Lips like freshly spilled blood. The Empress Su Daji was on this ship. Tyr was so surprised he nearly stumbled out of the shadows. Why was she here? His first thought was absurdly petty. Did she not trust him to take care of this on his own? Something had to have gone wrong. Was she here of her own volition? Had the Federation compelled her to come? Or had his own orders changed? Tyr's mind raced frantically, wondering how to react. He could act now, kill the soldiers before they could hurt the Empress. But Daji knew he was here. She would have signaled him if she wanted the Federation men dead. He was to wait then. Wait and watch what Daji's play was.
Your Highness!
General Jin Seryu was a massive soldier, a giant among men. He towered over the Empress.
You have been long in coming. The Emperor Ryohai grows impatient with you.
I am not Ryohai's dog to command.
Daji's voice resounded across the ship, cool and clear as ice, sharp as knives. A circle of soldiers formed around Daji, closing her in with the general. But Daji stood tall, chin raised, betraying no fear.
But you will be summoned,
the general said harshly.
The Emperor Ryohai grows irritated with your dallying. Your advantages are dwindling. You hold precious few cards, and this you know. You should be glad the Emperor has deigned to speak to you at all.
Daji's lip curled.
His Excellency is certainly gracious.
Enough of this banter. Speak your piece.
All in due time, Daji said calmly. But first, another matter to attend to.
And she looked directly into the shadows where Tyr stood.
Good. You're here.
Tyr took that for his signal. Knives raised, he rushed from the shadows, only to stumble to his knees as Daji arrested him with her gaze. He choked, unable to speak. His limbs were numb, frozen. It was all he could do to remain upright. Daji had the power of hypnosis, he knew, but never had she used it on him. All thoughts were pushed from his mind. All he could think about were her eyes. They were at first large, luminous and black, and then they were yellow like a snake's, with narrow pupils that drew him in like a mother grasping at her baby, like a cruel imitation of his own goddess. And like his goddess, she was so beautiful. So very beautiful. Transfixed, Tyr lowered his knives. Visions danced before him. Her great yellow eyes pulsed in his gaze. Suddenly gigantic, they filled his entire field of sight to the periphery, drew him into her world. He saw shapes without names. He saw colors beyond description. He saw faceless women dancing through vermilion and cobalt, bodies curved like the silk ribbons they spun in their hands. Then, as her prey was entranced, the vipress slammed down into him with her fangs and flooded him with poison. The psycho-spiritual assault was devastating and immediate. She shattered Tyr's world like glass, like he existed in a mirror and she had dashed it against a sharp corner. And he was arrested in the moment of breaking, so that it was not over in seconds but took place over eons. Somewhere a shriek began and grew higher and higher in pitch, and did not stop. The vipress's eyes turned a colorless white that bored into his vision and turned everything into pain. Tyr sought refuge in the shadows, but his goddess was nowhere, and those hypnotic eyes were everywhere. Everywhere he turned, the eyes looked upon him. The great snake hissed, her gaze trained on him, boring into him, paralyzing him. Tyr called out for his goddess again, but still she was silent. She had been driven away by a power that was infinitely stronger than darkness itself. Su-Da-Ji had channeled something older than the Empire. Something as old as time. Tyr's world ceased to spin. He and the Empress drifted alone together in the eye of the hurricane of colors, stabilized only by her generosity. He took a form again, and so did she. No longer a viper, but a goddess in the shape of Su-Da-Ji, the woman.
Do not resent me for this. There are forces at play you could not possibly understand, against which your life is irrelevant. Although she appeared mortal, her voice came from everywhere, originated within him, vibrated in his bones. It was the only thing that existed, until she relented and let him speak.
"Why are you doing this?" Tyr whispered.
"Pray do not question the motives of the predator," hissed the thing that was not Su-Da-Ji. "The dead do not question the living. Mortals do not challenge the gods."
"I killed for you," Tyr said. "I would have done anything for you."
"I know," she said, and stroked his face. She spoke with a casual sorrow, and for an instant she sounded like the Empress again. The colors dimmed. "You were fools." She pushed him off the ship.
The pain of drowning, Tyr realized, came in the struggle. But he could not struggle. He was every part of him paralyzed, unable to blink, even to shut his eyes against the stinging assault of salt water. Tyr could do nothing then but die. He sank back into the darkness, back into the deep, where sounds could not be heard, sights could not be seen. Where nothing could be felt. Where nothing lived. Back into the soft stillness of the womb. Back to his mother. Back to his goddess. The death of a shaman did not go unnoticed in the world of spirit. The shattering of Tyr sent a psycho-spiritual shockwave across the realm of things unknown. It was felt far away in the peaks of the Wudong Mountains, where the night castle stood hidden from the world. It was felt by the seer of the bizarre children, the lost son of the last true Khan of the hinterlands.
The pale seer traversed the spirit plane as easily as passing through a door, and when he looked for his commander, he saw only darkness and the shattered outline of what had once been human. He saw, on the horizon of things yet to come, a land covered